So, welcome to Mirage Profiles. That's the fancy name I came up with when thinking about this. And so what is this? This is a small podcast project happening right now here in 2017 in Marrakesh, where we've all gathered for something that is called Mirage Retreat. And yeah, we want to talk about programming, we want to talk about people, we want to talk about a bit about this event and why it's happening. And I want to talk to people, and the first person I'm talking to is Anil. Anil Madhva, no, I haven't got it right. Madhva Pedi.
Oh, very good.
All right.
That was very well pronounced.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Anil, who are you and what brought you to programming in your life?
So I'm an academic at the moment in Cambridge, in the Cambridge Computer Laboratory, and I've been stuck there now since 2002. So I went there to do a PhD, and before that I did a lot of work on systems programming. So I wrote a lot of open source code in OpenBSD, mm-hmm. and worked at NASA on the Mars projects, and worked in storage systems. And I went back to do a PhD on trying to build more reliable computer systems, so trying to figure out how to architect them so that we would not be constantly battling low-level bugs and buffer overflows and integer errors and so on for the rest of our lives. So the entire effort to start rebuilding things in a more structured, reliable way started in 2003 when I began some experiments with my colleague Dave Scott in rewriting internet protocols in a more functional, reliable, mathematically sound style. And before we knew it, everything had snowballed out of control, and we started rewriting the operating systems and all of the code around it, and we ended up forming Mirage OS in 2007.
So you already did that in OCaml?
Yes. So what happened was we looked around all of the programming languages at the time in the early 2000s, and that was a time when PHP and Perl were very dominant. It was the age of scripting languages. And they weren't really, a lot of the languages we take for granted now, like Rust and Go, just didn't even exist. Mm-hmm. OCaml is now 22 years old, so it's been around for a very long time. And it was actually largely invented in Cambridge as well. A chap called Robin Milner built it to build verification systems there's a meta language for proof systems. So ML's always been a very pragmatic language. It's been used to build real-world theorem provers and systems like that. And what we did was we took OCaml and we used it in industry. So we used it as part of the Zen hypervisor. We wrote the whole tool stack for Zen using it in 2004. And we got more and more experience with using OCaml as a very nice way to build native code compiled fast systems applications, but build them in a functional style.
Have you looked at other functional programming languages at that time?
Yes. So back in the days, the main competitor was Haskell. There was also a few more esoteric ones. Things like Miranda, for example, were still around back then, and Standard ML. And Erlang was beginning to become more and more popular as well. So the reason we picked OCaml was primarily that it was the most like C that we could find. It's the most like C in terms of its execution model. So in the sense that it's strictly evaluated, it had for loops and while loops. Sometimes it's simple things. And we just didn't understand how Haskell worked with all of its lazy evaluation and stuff. So I'm not really a programming language person. So then after a while, we started talking to colleagues who are working in Haskell and similar languages and realized that the evaluation model is very important for systems, because having a strictly evaluated language where you can reason about the memory usage and the performance at compile time is a really useful attribute as you build larger and larger code bases.
That's still a battle in the programming language world. If you look like recent developments, for instance, the Swift development language that Apple is pushing also has sort of astonished people by being more close to the core than other language approaches.
That's right. So I think that the industry has entered a world now where almost every megacorp has its own domain-specific language for its platform. So Swift is a DSL on top of Objective-C and that reference counting model that that Apple has, and Android has similar ones, you know, with the many JVM based languages, and Go in many ways is a DSL for building lightweight Unix concurrency. So the thing we like about OCaml is that you can express a lot of the abstractions for these high level things in OCaml itself. So we've built lightweight threading libraries, device drivers, non allocating kind of inner loops that are very very low level. And OCaml can express all of these in the same language. It's in very many ways, it's a functional imperative object-oriented programming language that combines all of the paradigms into one system.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good sweet spot between.
So it looks as if ML or OCaml in particular has always been very close to the operating system level. So it's being used in the VM world, in the hypervisor world, thinking about using it in an operating system context is somehow natural.
That's right. So what happened was that when we were building Xen, we had to build a very complicated API for Xen to show to IBM, because we were just a small startup at the time and we had to impress them. So we built this thing.
Are we talking about the foundation of Xen, or is it?
Well, so it's a control stack, yeah. So it's the thing that runs the. Every time a virtual machine boots, it has something called ZenStore. And ZenStore is the thing that coordinates all of the interactions between the domain zero, which is a privileged domain, with the device drivers, with the Xen hypervisor itself. So every single control operation Xen goes through this OCaml code called ZenStore. In the early days, that was just the core of it. And then we had to expose more and more functionality like storage, device drivers, networking plugins, all the things to make a real cloud. So we wrote this complicated-looking API in OCaml that generated a LaTeX document that we gave to IBM. And this LaTeX document had all of the details of a very complicated data center management API, but it didn't exist. It was just a LaTeX document. So then what we did in the course of a few weeks was we filled in the blanks and we replaced the LaTeX with actual code that did the actual operations that we talked about. And before we knew it, we had the entirety of Xen Server, which is the core Xen distribution now sold by Citrix and is open source as well. So the OCaml code was beautiful for shaping the API, for designing it, to getting the high-level model. And then we just continued and filled in the blanks and we built all the low-level bits and pieces.
So it's more or less, so we're talking about Mirage as an operating system effort. Sounds like it's more like built by operating system by accident. Somehow,
that's right.
You were discovering that you are already building the foundation of a new OS while filling in the blanks for something else.
That's exactly it. So one of the beautiful things about OCaml is that you don't have to have a grand plan when you're building the code with OCaml. It excels at refactoring. So you can take fragments of code and then repurpose them in different contexts. So over the years, we've written hundreds of million lines of OCaml code, but a lot of it's been refactoring. And I don't think there's a better language than ML for this, because the language gives you all of the abilities to make a change and find all of the call sites where the errors would happen. It's got static types. So what happened with Mirage was we discovered this new concept called library operating systems, which is that you don't actually need to have a single prescriptive operating system running around controlling all your resources. You can actually have a set of libraries that define policies for things like storage and scheduling and booting and so on. And then you can compose those libraries together into a bootable operating system. And this idea kind of blew our minds, because it meant that we had all of these libraries in OCaml that implemented most of an operating system, and all we had to do was fill in the blanks. You know, we just needed a TCP stack. We already had the low-level Xen stuff for controlling virtual hardware. We had the high-level web libraries, and we just had to build the connective glue to kind of fit that together. So after 6 years of Xen and OCaml and so on, we suddenly realized that in a weekend, we could actually just build something that directly ran on top of Xen without needing all of the intermediate emulations and Linuxes and so on. And so a bit of a frenzy of hacking was joined by Thomas Resnier and David Scott and I, and we just put a unikernel together in 2007. And it booted and it served a website very, very slowly and very unreliably, but it did work. And then the next decade since then has been filling in the blanks with all the libraries to make sure that we have an implementation of every single protocol on the planet that is openly specified.
So what exactly do you mean by unikernel?
So unikernel is kind of a marketing term. The idea there is, if you have an application, normally you need to boot it on an operating system and then you supply it with a configuration file. And all of these things are very loosely coupled, because the operating system knows nothing about the configuration file until it runs and boots the whole thing. But sometimes, if you look at the entire picture, you can specialize these things by the more knowledge you have. So we thought, well, why not make the application, operating system, and configuration file expressed in the same programming language, and then compile it all together into one thing? So for example, if I have a web server that is not using SSL, it can remove all of the things involving any security. If I have a DNS server that's not using TCP, it will simply eliminate all of the code involving TCP. If I have a web server that's listening only to port 80 and no other ports, it can remove all of the port management code automatically. So this unikernel, the idea is that you just simply express everything in one framework, the application, the configuration, the hardware target, and it'll compile the most optimal thing possible. So we did a demonstration to VeriSign. We won the Internet Infrastructure Award in 2010, I think it was, when we built a DNS server that was 200 kilobytes in size, faster than all of the other DNS servers on the planet for authoritative serving, and completely type-safe from the device driver up. So just by using functional memoization and techniques to speed things up. So you could do some really cool demos with unikernels back in those days.
Well, just leaving out stuff doesn't really make things more secure when you finally find out that you need everything else anyway.
That's right. That's right.
So what would you say is the intrinsic security idea here in Mirage that makes it different to other systems?
So the choice of language is very important, because building it in ML means that you have all of the nice functional abstraction and features that we're used to in functional programming. So you can, for example, declare an abstract type and not know anything about the implementation of it, and very, very efficiently use these abstractions and compose them together. So OCaml is very good for large-scale programming like this. But secondly, the big thing that made a difference to us was the cloud, because the idea that we're breaking up monolithic applications that would, in the past, everything would have been put into one place. We now had this idea of microservices where I'm building, for example, a storage server that only does storage. It doesn't need to do anything else. And that is served as a bit of virtual hardware in the cloud. And then I might have a front-end web accelerator. I might have a DNS load balancer. And each of these things are discrete components you can deploy using software APIs on Amazon or Azure or Google Cloud or whatever cloud provider you're using. So this enabled us to show that unikernels could be even better, because it avoided the pitfall that you just described. Normally in the past, applications would have been all in one. And now people are building microservices that split them discreetly into domain-specific purposes. And once you have a domain-specific purpose, you can specialize it by using a compiler. So we built storage systems that were highly specialized based on Git-based reconciliation. And they'd simply eliminated a lot of the overhead. They didn't have a scheduler for anything other than storage scheduling, for example. So you could build appliances that did one thing and one thing well.
So it's not only a solution for hosting or hypervisors, it's also coming into play for ideas like IoT, Internet.
That's right.
Of things, which usually means not well-maintained small
that's
hardware.
That's exactly right. So in fact, originally we had a project called the LifeDB, which was in 2007. It was an attempt to build a system that would centralize your personal data, so you didn't have to use hosting providers and so on. This is before, you know, before Facebook even existed. And to deploy trusted systems like this, where you are the system administrator, is very difficult, because I would have to explain to my family how to update a computer system. With unikernels, everything is compiled. Every line of code is understood in an automated build system. So it becomes very, very easy to use a CI system to deploy them automatically and make sure they remain up to date. Because you don't assemble anything that isn't in the unikernel. You have to compile the whole thing, right? So it gives you just a very cheap way of knowing everything that's going into your infrastructure. Mm-hmm. The powerful thing about these library operating systems is that the more libraries you have, the more flexibility you have for the things you want to put together. So it's like any other set of libraries, where if you have an ecosystem, and this is what's happening right now with Mirage in the last 10 years, we have more and more options for how to customize and build these bespoke systems as a programmer. So, for example, a bunch of us from Mirage set up a startup, and we got acquired by Docker. Docker is this incredibly powerful and popular container management system, and we wanted to integrate unikernels into this thing to make it even more secure and better. But as always with these things, we went down an unexpected path. Docker had to work on the Mac and on Windows. And the problem with that is that it's a Linux system that to run containers on Linux. So we used unikernels to build a native Mac and Windows app that would dynamically translate using the Mirage libraries between, for example, a Mac OS and Linux file system. So you could have your website in a Linux container, but mapped onto your Mac, so you could use all your nice IDEs and so on to manage your website. And this required incredible attention to detail. So the differences between the file systems and the two are very significant. The way that activations work in the file system are different, and we made it completely invisible, so it just worked. And this involves every byte of every network and storage packet in Docker for Mac going through the Mirage libraries. So we use the libraries as an adapter between operating systems instead of building a new operating system. And that's now got millions of users and is a very popular... we solve the problem at hand, which is what you want to do as a working programmer, right? No drama.
Yeah, if you talk to programmers about programming languages, they knew a few, they knew some of the new fancy stuff. OCaml is really in the invisible field, I would say.
That's right.
It's not so many people. So do you have problems getting more people into the community?
It's a good question. It's for any community, you have to ask what your goals are. And some communities have popularity as a goal. For OCaml, it's never been popularity. It's always been the desire to build a very sound core that we can use as the basis for building reliable systems. So the author of OCaml, Zev Eloi, was also instrumental in the design of the Coq proof assistant and has recently in the last decade built one of the world's first certified C compiler. So he's been over the decades working through patiently building reliable systems on top of reliable systems to end up with, you know, certified machine-checked systems that can be used in the real world.
Certified by whom?
So certified by mathematics. so the
like
idea...
Like verified software.
Verified, both specified and verified. So the idea is you specify its behavior, and then you verify that it's meeting the purpose at hand. So Mirage is in a similar space where we're just patiently building reliable protocols and reliable implementations of things, rewriting them again and again until they're right. And then we're pretty much at the point today. We have a series of really robust, well-specified implementations of open protocols. Now, for OCaml itself, it seems very unpopular, but it's actually one of the most widely deployed languages in the world. So Facebook, for example, the whole of Messenger.com is 80% written in OCaml, compiled to JavaScript, and the native applications also use it as well, the React native technology that they have. And companies like Jane Street have used OCaml for years, trade billions and billions of dollars in a purely OCaml platform. So typically, we're a small community, but it's a very happy community, actually. So we're just getting on with maintaining the core. We have regular, healthy meetings. Most of OCaml development is done from Cambridge and from INRIA in France, in Paris, where the main compiler development team is. And I work with a set of colleagues in a group called OCaml Labs in Cambridge, where we maintain all of the tooling and the platform stuff. So I kind of advanced from realizing in Mirage in the early days that we just didn't have the basic tooling to use OCaml at scale. And so we acquired the funding, and Thomas Cazini, one of the Mirage co-founders, wrote the OCaml package manager called OPAM. And we've just been sucked into making all the tools much, much better. So in fact, next year we're preparing a release of the OCaml platform, which is one of the biggest reboots of the OCaml tooling we've ever done. So we've rewritten build systems, documentation, syntax extensions, and we package them all up into one easy-to-consume method. But I'm worried because I think it might make us a little bit more popular than we want. but really, it's for our internal developers to make sure that everyone using OCaml right now has a nice sustainable base of IDE support and documentation and so on. So we're getting there. But our goal has never been popularity.
I think it's a privileged position to be able to somehow constantly rewrite your own code and somehow, before it becomes popular, to have removed as much legacy code that could be nasty in the future as possible.
It's an incredible privilege. I mean, we've been lucky to have witnessed the growth of the cloud, which is the thing that I think really financed us, because at every step of the way, we've deployed our software, we've used it on millions and often billions of devices. And then we've had the chance to, you know, leave whatever startup or mechanism it was, go back to university, start another round of research, and to keep rebuilding on our source code base. So we've been using the same source code base for the last 15 years, just across 5 jobs, 3 startups, you know, multiple research projects funded by many, many people, by a government project with DARPA. So the ability to have an open source base, good liberal licensing, and a solid language has been what's let this movement continue for as long as it has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talking about the community, we're here, I mentioned it already, in Marrakesh right now. Hannes Mehnert has organized this for, I think, the third time.
The third time, yeah.
Have you been here the first 2 times as well?
So I haven't. So the way I met Hannes is that 5 years ago we needed a TLS stack, and we had no TLS stack. We had no idea how to rewrite this thing on OCaml. And these two guys mailed me from a beach in Morocco, in Merleft, saying, we heard about what you needed. We heard you on a podcast and we've written you a TLS stack. And I went, this is not possible. A TLS stack would take years to write. Right? This is super complicated stuff. They sent me some code and they were indeed on a beach in Morocco writing a TLS stack from scratch and ASN1 and X509 and everything involved, and it worked. So they came to Cambridge on an internship and they worked with us, and Hannah's, David is now doing a PhD in Cambridge, and Hannah's is just moving back to Germany after working happily in Cambridge for 3 years. And they've been instrumental in bootstrapping a wider community for us. So Hannah's has been organizing this in Morocco. It's become a tradition because it started in Merleft with our security base, and he's built up some great relationships here to make sure we can do this on an ongoing basis. And we've had over 40 people here, I think, now.
So I mean, where would you expect a Mirage to show up
indeed,
if it's not in the desert?
Indeed, we just need a camel to show up in Cambridge now and we'll be fine. So it's slightly surreal to see so many people hacking on this obscure operating system. But it's everyone's happy and the code is open and everything's heading in the right direction. So I think life can get no better than this.
Yeah, and I think it's very important to have these real-life meetings too.
That's right.
If you look at the dynamics here, it's like a week of a retreat. Basically, people are just hanging around hacking, but every now and then they come together, talk about their progress, and whenever you have this crazy idea how maybe you could do something else,
the person
that you should talk to is probably just sitting next to you.
I think I've met everyone from researchers from IBM to people who work for the German government to people who are working in open source systems and crypto anarchy and so on. So all kinds of diversity here. So it's but the code unifies them all. It's good fun.
So talking about the possible future popularity of this system, I heard that Facebook, well, you already mentioned Facebook is using it. Mm. I think they've also proposed a different syntax for the same thing.
That's right. So OCaml is characterized by being quite hackable in both the front end and the back end. So it's really easy to embed it in all kinds of exotic systems because the runtime is very lightweight. The front end is also very, very easy to extend. So what Facebook have done is quite a smart idea, I think. If your goal is to popularize a language, and OCaml is 22 years old, it's very hard to go to your manager and say, you've missed this amazing thing for 22 years and you have to use it now. No one will pick up on that. But if you give it a fresh lick of paint, a new website, a syntax that is more familiar to users, then it's a new thing and anyone can pick it up without shame, right? Why haven't you been programming OCaml all this time? Well, it's not a problem anymore. So what ReasonML is, which is their syntax, is it's the exact same OCaml toolchain, including the same abstract syntax tree and so on, but a different surface syntax. And the tooling to seamlessly translate back and forth between OCaml and ReasonML. So then you use the entire OCaml ecosystem, and anything that they write in ReasonML, we can also trivially translate back into OCaml if we choose to. And so it's directly growing the ecosystem. But what they're doing is that they're specializing towards web programming. So the author of React, which is a very, very popular JavaScript framework, is the same person who founded ReasonML, Jordan Walk. And so he's been great in assembling a team in Facebook, finding the problems that require solution, but also making sure that all of the details that need to be fixed are fixed. So obviously to ship something as popular as Facebook or even a compiler like OCaml is just attention to 100,000 small details that can make the whole thing go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So things like the latency of the JavaScript compile GC, making sure there's not a single unnecessary instruction in the hot path so that it's as performant as handwritten JavaScript, making sure that it's community accessible and has the right interactions with the JavaScript community, so NPM integration and so on. So they've been focusing on all of that. But meanwhile, of course, everything they do strengthens OCaml. But it also strengthens it in a good way because we're not set up as a community to deal with a million JavaScript developers showing up tomorrow. So the ReasonML community is dealing with that and then feeding us back bug reports and telling us exactly how to evolve our tooling and our platforms to make it better for them as well.
But don't you think it could also be problematic to have sort of two different syntaxes hanging around?
I think for domain-specific purposes, it's completely fine. So the people programming JavaScript frontends are typically they have a very different set of problems and motivations from ones working on proof assistants or compilers. So if there's a domain-specific syntax that looks more like JavaScript for JavaScript libraries, that's completely fine. So one of the things about OCaml is that we've had a 20-year history of extensible grammars. So there's something like OCaml P4 where you could not only do code generation from source code, you could also extend the grammar of the language dynamically. So you could build these plugins that would just extend and move on and do different things, but also maintain type safety and so on through the compilation pipeline.
So more a macro system that's somehow putting DSLs on top of the core language.
That's right. Yeah. So you could do, you could, for example, do type T with S expression, and it would generate the S expression translation functions for the type definition. So a lot of this stuff led to a lot of problems because, you know, anyone could extend the type, the grammar of the language in different directions. But the community rapidly settled onto a set of conventions for how to do this. So we've had many, many syntaxes over the years. It's not a good place to fight any kind of meaningful battle, I think, because if a user community wants a particular syntax, it's a user interface to the language, we should have it. We don't have one user interface to our computers. We have many, many domain-specific ways of accessing our information. The same should be true of languages as well.
Yeah, and it's not the only place where this happens. For instance, the Erlang community was recently joined by the Elixir project, which also somehow took the same approach, like, oh yeah, the VM you have, your abstractions you have, the thinking behind how you approach code and how you think about software, that's fine. We just want to have like a modern, fresh, more commonly understood way of writing the code.
That's right, that's right. I don't think any language can survive for more than a decade if it doesn't embrace new ideas that help it refresh its development cycle. So Camel has rebooted itself many, many times, and we're going to have to do another fun reboot next year as well. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't change the fundamentals of the language. The code I wrote in 2003 still compiles. In fact, one of the great things that happened in the hackathon here is that Christian Haysbert just wrote a new SSH implementation in Pure Camel, and that was the protocol I first started off in my PhD in 2003 to rewrite SSH. So he's finally retired code I wrote 14 years ago, and not a minute too soon. That was terrible code I wrote back then. So I can finally, but the continuity is so important. So no matter what syntax you write in, what code generators you use, the fundamentals of the OCaml type system are still the same Hindley-Miller type inference algorithm that was, designed in the 70s and 80s and 90s. So it's got a nice intellectual kind of background that's backing the soundness of the language. And that means it'll survive for another 50 years. It's in pretty good shape.
So what would you say is the state of Mirage OS right now, and what is the next frontier that needs to be reached?
So Mirage is struggling with growth right now. We released Mirage 3 last year, and it's leapt from being a fairly obscure project to having millions of daily users because of the use in Docker, and the libraries are being used by a growing number of people, like James Street and Facebook and so on. So as a community, we've historically been very small, and we've never really had anyone working in Mirage full-time. So now, with the popularity, we have two of the core developers now working on it full-time. They're looking for jobs and discovered that they are already overbooked, and people are basically lining up to ask for customizations and library extensions and so on. So it's a very good sign. But the next release of Mirage will basically incorporate the next generation of OCaml tooling as well. So we have... we've been busily behind the scenes. We're managing around 100 Git repositories now. So it's gone from just one repository to just a lot of libraries and implementations and hundreds of contributors and so on. So the challenge is, how do we make sure the quality of the core remains good?
Hundreds that are just hanging around, or hundreds that actually make up the whole system?
It depends, because it's a highly customizable system. Yeah. It depends on which protocol stack you want to build. So if you're building a TLS website, then you'll pull in maybe 60 to 70 of those libraries. Mm-hmm. It's everything from device drivers for Xen to TLS stacks to crypto layers to just imagine all the small libraries you have to glue together into a real system.
So we're talking about actually useful stuff, not just a Sudoku done in...
Oh, yeah, no, there's many, many of those. We're not even counting at the moment. And so all these are in the OPAM package manager. So we're preparing big releases of OPAM 2, which is the new package manager release. We're working with the OCaml development team to build a central documentation site. So you can go to docs.mirage.io and find all the documentation for all the libraries. These seem like simple things, but it's a lot of infrastructure. It requires, hundreds of gigabytes of builds and so on to make sure all these libraries compile with all of the different OCaml versions and so on. So continuous integration, CI, quality, and tooling is where we're looking at right now. Mm-hmm. And we've got some pretty ambitious plans as well. We've just had ARM64 support merged in. So a lot of people are looking at IoT and exactly what the future that we want to live in should look like. And that basically involves taking a lot of the protocol stacks, building open specialized systems that protect our personal data and our privacy, and build usable systems at the end of the day. So the DataBox project in the UK is a government-funded project between Cambridge, Nottingham, and Imperial College. And so their programmers are here as well. So we're figuring out how do we combine Mirage and DataBox to build a genuine, secure, specialized personal data management system for the future that doesn't involve giving your data away to, you know, corporations and so on, unless you choose to do that yourself. So bring control back to the user and then take it from there. But it incorporates all of the really good properties of Mirage, because Mirage is a set of libraries, and the policies come from the DataBox project. You know, how to use these libraries we built. But then what we will supply to them is our bulletproof, type-safe, drama-free libraries that will just do their job. And then they can fight their battles on data protection and all of the things that have to happen. Critically, they will not just get hacked overnight by, you know, some low-level buffer overflow, hopefully, if we do our job right. So it's a beautiful synergy, I think, between these projects happening right now.
So I think all the work that's flowing into Mirage OS is also flowing back into the language itself. Is there anything you see where the language itself is evolving? What is probably the influence of other popular languages that are currently being used and developed?
So my group, led by Casey Sivaramakrishnan, is working on one of the biggest changes to OCaml in the last decade, so multi-core OCaml. So we have designed a system where we have a really simple, elegant concurrency and parallelism model in the language. So the parallelism is based on a memory model that has been designed that is much simpler than C++ and Java. So when you write the semantics down of C++ or Java from a multi-threaded perspective, they could fill many volumes. And our operational semantics are half a page. So we've adopted, by construction, a very simple but reasonably performant model for multi-threading.
But the influence here might be probably even more Erlang or systems who have been doing this forever.
That's right. So a lot of these systems don't actually have formal memory models. Only really C++ and Java have written down what it means to be data erase free and what happens in the presence of data erases and so on. So we were surprised by this. We wrote down a formal memory model for OCaml, and we're hoping to transfer this to other languages as well. So JavaScript, for example, there's a whole bunch of proposals for memory models. If the world goes in the wrong way, it'll use C++ and Java's, which are way too complicated. If it goes, hopefully, if we think the right way, it'll adopt OCaml's much simpler but very performant memory models that are conservative, but they do not expose all the craziness to the developer, right? It's just...
So we're not only talking about the language being capable of multi-threading your software, you're actually nailing it down to the last bit on defining how this is represented in memory. And
yes, so the trick of any modern language is that you have to understand every last detail of the microarchitectures you're compiling to. So you have to compile to not just x86, but also ARM64, ARM32, PowerPC. We've historically supported alphas, for example, with interesting kind of TLB characteristics.
There's still MIPS around.
And RISC-V, we have active support for the new open system. So all of these, we want all of them to be supported equally. It's not just an x86 world. So in our memory model, x86 multi-threading is the same cost as C++, and ARM is 0.6% slower. So it's a tiny, tiny bit slower. But in return for that, we get a vast amount of simplicity and so on. But also one of the other big effects is that, and this pun was intended, we have a system called algebraic effects in the language, which is a really nice way of expressing concurrency in OCaml. So before, there was many different ways to compose schedulers. You'd have to build a thread scheduler, and it would be pthreads, or it would have its own kind of policies. But one of the lessons from Mirage is that if everything is a library, then the application can customize things and specialize things much, much more easily. So why not do this for threads and scheduling? Why, only the application knows exactly how it's using its threads. So if you just supply an application scheduler and compose that with the actual use of concurrency in the application, you could do all kinds of cool stuff, right? And of course, the languages supply default schedulers, but you could override them anytime. If you're doing more I/O for files, you could do one thing. If you're doing network programming or some kind of, you know, dynamic programming with memory data structures, you could do different things. So the new OCaml algebraic effects system that we're proposing lets you supply, written in OCaml, your own schedulers for your own concurrent code. So you can just put these things together in very, very nice ways where you can express the essence of your algorithms in ML, and then the dynamic execution properties of it in the scheduler as well. And this is kind of a holy grail for programming languages. Algebraic effects have seen a lot of research in the last 10 years, and we've been working hard and gluing them together into a practical, realistic system that works, you know, for 100% of the OCaml features, not just for a prototype. So we're aiming to propose that for upstream OCaml in the middle of next year, and we have prototypes available already.
But it might put some stress on OCaml programmers thinking about parallelism in the first place. I mean, one of the advantages I think systems like Erlang have brought up, that once you are introduced to the concept of the language and the environment, you start off think in parallel from the get-go. Once you've done everything more or less single-threaded, and then you just have like, oh, look, now you can do things in parallel, you're tempted not to make real use of it. How would you approach this?
That's a real challenge. So the answer there is high-level libraries, high-level abstractions for most programmers to use. So you rarely program at a low-level thread thing in OCaml. You build abstractions like STM, for example. If you want to build a sequential composition, we have a library called Reagents where you can glue together data structures in a very simple way, and the Reagents library will take care of parallelizing those interactions. So it's a way of composing parallel operations together in a safe way and make transactional guarantees. So the idea is that we provide the low-level primitives in the language, and then normal library authors can build abstractions using normal OCaml features. And in fact, you can build exactly the Erlang type model in the new system as well. So, but the key thing is you give choice. Erlang is appropriate for one domain of applications. Sometimes you need much more tightly coupled parallelism for, you know, particular scientific computing algorithms. Sometimes you want to have extremely fast I/O for building, you know, 48 core network servers and so on. All of those can be expressed in the new system. What we don't know is which of these libraries will win, because probably each of them will be used for different domain-specific purposes. So we're going to release a diaspora of libraries and see what happens. But at no point, we hope, will programmers be forced to do the low-level programming that it is after functional programming. The idea is to program in high-level abstractions. We just don't know what those are yet. We have 7 or 8 different libraries as proposals for different problem domains, and then we're going to spend next year figuring out which of those work properly for which domains.
Last question. If you are approached by somebody who is new to programming or is somehow starting with the idea, like young people, what programming language would you recommend to start with?
So I can only reply what we do in Cambridge. So I'm faculty in computer science in Cambridge. And what do you think the first language that we teach our undergraduates is on the very first day?
I hope it's Lisp or something like this.
It's ML, because our Foundations in Computer Science course teaches ML, because it is the simplest way to get to grips with the fundamentals of computer science. The idea of composing lists and functions and values and building these successive series of high-level abstractions. So ML is a wonderful place to start. Now, it's not a very accessible language, but if you want to learn computer science, it's by far the best way to go. And many US universities and French universities adopt the same approach. What's been missing, though, of course, is having a nice teaching platform for this. And OCaml in the last 3 years has had a MOOC. It's had many different kind of online teaching platforms built for making it more accessible. And in Cambridge, we're actually rebooting these things next year in order to have more JavaScript-based teaching platforms and so on. But ML, at its core, the simple ML is what I'd recommend. Now, if you're 15 or 16, if you're not at university yet, you haven't finished your mathematical degrees, there's many interesting options. The Raspberry Pi community has been working really well on Python. There's really good basis libraries to do interactive programming in Jupyter notebooks and so on. So really any of those are fine. But when it comes to computer science, learning the basic fundamentals, ML is just such a simple, clear thing to teach students.
And I think once you want to call yourself a real programmer, you have to know more than one language anyway, because otherwise you can't appreciate what you have.
That's right. You know, we should learn all the languages eventually, right?
All right, Anil, thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That was so much fun.
Okay, goodbye.